This is Block by Block, a community news program from WPPM LP 106.5 FM, where we explore issues affecting the Philadelphia area with news reports from members of the community. I'm Samantha Roll.
And I'm Helen Horstman Allen. In the next half hour, we'll hear stories from our community news reporters about a recent youth mental health summit, two new bookshops in the area that are dedicated to romance books, a science educator who takes Philadelphians on moth walks to get up close and personal with the city's bugs, and a DJ bringing line dancing to the heart of Philly's gayborhood.
But first, this summer, SEPTA responded to a budget shortfall by raising fares and reducing service. While bus and train service is back to normal now, the fares have not gone back down. Block by Block reporter Kennedy Scurry spoke with Stephen Bronskill to find out more about how this happened and what riders in the region should expect next. Bronskill is coalition manager for an advocacy organization called Transit Forward Philly. He says SEPTA's current budget crisis can be traced back to the start of the COVID-19 pandemic.
SEPTA ridership, along with transit ridership all across the country, fell to about 12% of what it normally is, right? So many folks had to work from home or concerned about health and safety. And so what took place is the federal government said, here's some money to get us through this period of time. Those dollars stopped in September of 2024. SEPTA's done actually amazing compared to the rest of the country, but I think we're at about 80% of ridership.
Okay.
The pandemic. Yeah, so it went from 12 to 80, which is pretty good. It increased 4% last year, right? If your business is increasing 4% a year, it's pretty good. But it's still not 100. Mm-hmm. And so federal money was cut off, especially with the change of administration. And locally in Philadelphia, we are not able to do what some other cities that have transit agencies do. Places like New York and San Francisco, and Los Angeles, Chicago, we can't put something on the ballot that says, hey, Philly is going to invest in itself. We just, by the Pennsylvania Constitution, can't do it. So it fell to the state government. About two-thirds of SEPTA's funding comes from the state. We needed them to come up with a solution to fill the gap. SEPTA was short about $213 million. And in the spring, they basically said, hey, if we don't have a solution from the state, there are many ways to get there. We spend about the same amount of money subsidizing horse racing in Pennsylvania. If you're into horse racing, that's great. But I do think people getting around Philly is also really important, right? We said not just SEPTA, but the Pittsburgh Transit Agency, also our friends up in the Lehigh Valley and in Reading, and every single state senate district has a transit agency that we're all facing this issue. We said to our state government, we really need folks to step up and find a solution, or else we're going to see cuts not just in Philly, but all across the state. So SEPTA put out their plan. They said, if we don't get this money, we got to cut 50 bus lines, a 9 p.m. curfew. And so the work that we've been doing is try to mobilize riders. Like, I don't have a car. I take SEPTA to get around everywhere.
Okay.
Saying, look, like this is how I get to work or school or go visit my family or go to a medical appointment, right? Mm-hmm. This is so important. Like, please prioritize this in the budget.
Do you believe that fares will eventually go down, especially, like, again, it wasn't enough, you know, in the budget. But if it were to happen, how would that look?
As far as like more accessible fares. So a couple of things. So zero fare, absolutely. We'll be pushing that really hard. And we've got some events coming up for that. Another thing is the student fare card. So right now, if you live more than a mile and a half from your public school in Philly, you get a card that gets you to school and gets you home from school. I personally believe if you live a mile instead of a mile and a half, you should still get a fare card, right? It shouldn't be a distance. Also, if you're a student who works late, or maybe you've got an after school activity, or you just want to like go somewhere in the city, I think it should work around the clock, or at least more than just taking you to school, right? We know that there's so many opportunities in the city that if young people can get connected to them, who knows what they'll do. So I think helping students get access to those opportunities and transit is really important. We're also going to be helping university students and workplaces organize for key advantage benefits. This is something where your workplace could say, hey, as a benefit for working in this company, just like we're going to give you like health insurance, we'll also give you transit benefits. We believe that PHA, right, the Philadelphia Housing Authority, should offer this as a benefit for tenants. So we're going to be fighting to make sure more people have access to transit and that they are not having to pay the full fare. We also know, right, that we've got to invest in our system. So it is a balance, right, but we're going to be using every tool we possibly can to try to make this more accessible.
So tell us more about Transit for Philly and why you guys made it your duty to help with SEPTA and its, you know, city folks.
So we're a coalition of 37 organizations, everybody from unions, groups that advocate for seniors, people with disabilities, immigrant communities, neighborhoods in Philly that really just all share this goal, right? Of how do we help people move around the city safely, accessibly, sustainably? And so all of us helped in really different ways. I think that was one of the beautiful things about this campaign is some folks were out flyering all the bus stops. Others were talking to riders early in the morning on their commutes saying, this is how you talk to your elected officials. Some folks had like postcard parties. Everyone wrote their state senators, their state reps saying this is really important. And so, you know, we heard from state representatives who said, you know, I've never heard from this many folks about one specific issue before. And it was really cool just to see people raise their voice in lots of different creative ways.
When you think about mental health and well-being, you may think about the challenges that come with being an adult. Work, paying bills, engaging in politics. Kids face mental health challenges too, though, which can have a serious impact on their well-being. But there are a number of healthcare providers in the region that offer resources for young people. They recently held a Mental Health Youth Summit and Resource Fair in West Philadelphia. Block by Block reporter Vanessa Lowe attended the event and spoke with some of the leaders.
Hey there, so excited to be here today. Tell us your name and what we're doing here today.
My name is Freya Byers-Gilliam. I'm the Community Engagement Manager at Public Health Management Corporation, and I work mainly out of our Cedar campus at 54th and Cedar. I'm here today because we were supporting a youth mental health conference as well as the resource fair. It's really personal to me because I think that it's important for youth to have a safe space to not only share their emotions and feelings, but have a better understanding of how to cope with those different emotions. I think it's important for the parents to have an understanding of what kind of conversations need to happen in order to facilitate a safe space for those conversations to happen.
So what was a highlight about how the day went for you here today?
I just really always enjoy when community is able to come together and get the information that they need in one space. Sometimes it's really hard to access resources when you have to go to a multitude of locations. I love that we were able to have this here on a Saturday when some of these resources are not usually available, when people don't have time to go to these resources between school and work schedules. I just really enjoyed seeing the people come out to our location, like, you know, really seeing Philly show up for youth, mental health, for information, for resources, for community. The DJ was amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, so we're glad that people are getting to know us, getting to know the spaces, and getting more familiar with the programs that are available for them.
Fantastic. Is there a number or website they should call if they want to follow up?
Check out PHMC Health at phmc.org to learn more about our health centers and our dental clinic. To learn more about Public Health Management Corporation in general, you can check out phmc.org. PHMC hosts a diverse portfolio of all kinds of programs from mental health, evidence-based home visiting, family services, housing. It just really is a wealth of information all under one roof.
I was just in a session on AI, and I want the leader of that session to give the soundbite about what you presented, because it was really fascinating.
My name is Derek Tarver. I'm the founder and CEO of That Could Be Me Foundation. We were founded in 2021, and we use artificial intelligence creative expression technologies to teach social-emotional skills and coping skills.
And you just showed us an app that kids that you work with are using to essentially build their AI person and then look at certain things. So tell us about that.
One of the tools we use is called Magic Studio. It's a completely free, no login required tool that allows you to create images from prompts, from a simple sentence. And so we use this, though, in a really interesting way. We start the kids off with a StrengthsFinder exercise. We ask them to identify their top two strengths. And then tell the AI image generator to create an image of them as a superhero demonstrating their top two strengths. And so it accomplishes two things. One, it teaches them the skill of prompt engineering. Two, it allows them to really embrace their strengths. It's one thing to say, well, I'm strong and hardworking. It's another to look at an image that you created as a superhero demonstrating your strengths. Similarly, we use a tool called Suno, which is an AI music generator. Using those same top two strengths, create a song that demonstrates how you use your top two strengths. Ideally, how you use them to help others or help the community.
Yeah.
And so that's how we're using artificial intelligence. It's AI for good. It's AI for creative expression to express your emotions, but also to visualize. A big part of our curriculum is visioning, goal setting, problem solving, and resilience. And so what better way to say, well, my goal is to be a food service manager at Olive Garden. That's literally what one of the kids said. Mm-hmm. He said, okay, well, how are you going to get there? Yeah. What does it look like when you get there? Mm-hmm. So let's start with creating an image of your vision. And your vision should always be centered on how do you want to feel? What does that look like? And what do you value? What's important to you? Yeah. That's your vision.
Thank you so much. That was really fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Philadelphia is home to more than 1.5 million people, but we're not the only ones who live here. My co-host, Helen Horstmann Allen, brings us this story about a Philly area science educator who wants to bring us closer to our smallest neighbors and make a difference in our communities, one seed packet at a time.
Sarah McAnulty is a squid biologist turned professional science communicator. Since 2017, she's been connecting thousands of classrooms annually to scientists through her website, Skype a Scientist.
I sort of found that we were hitting the same populations over and over and over again. And I wanted to reach people where I live in Philadelphia and get a little creative and just sort of honestly have a little more fun playing around to see how we can connect people who aren't seeking out science information on the street in Philly.
This might have been a little harder than usual.
It was the height of the lockdown time of the pandemic.
So an outdoor activity was a must.
So I started spending nights in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey and learning a lot about animals that come out at night, mostly moths and beetles and bats and all sorts of stuff. So I started hosting moth nights. And I started that in the Pine Barrens because it is really close by, but it has incredible biodiversity. It's one of these like beautiful, unique ecosystems that we should really treasure. If you haven't been to the Pine Barrens, you should go. They're amazing.
Sarah wanted to test her model a little closer to home and share it with more of her neighbors. She brought moth nights to Philly parks.
This summer, I started hosting these in the city. I wasn't sure how it would go, but we see a lot of species at Norris Square Park, at Penn Treaty Park. We gather at dusk, we look for bats, and then we gather around a brightly lit with UV lights sheet that I hang on a string. And that bright light attracts the nocturnal insects. And so you just get a smorgasbord of critters on a white sheet that you can then easily observe, take pictures of, and just hang out with.
Engaging with the natural world becomes a muscle. Sarah wants to help people work theirs.
Honestly, the most surprising critter I've seen this year has been a gigantic stag beetle in Norris Square Park. We were there with just like a neighborhood cleanup in the morning, and a big orangish brown stag beetle. Those are the ones that have the big like pinchers on the front of their faces. This is the kind of thing you think of being like in the rainforest, not smack in the middle of Kensington.
With all the time spent observing bugs, Sarah definitely has a favorite.
Lightning bugs were one of my favorite things to interact with in nature as a kid. And I know that a lot of people, particularly who grew up around the area, have a real connection to lightning bugs. But in recent years, their populations have been declining for a wide variety of reasons. Climate change, the use of pesticides, and a loss of habitat.
Loss of habitat isn't just a problem for lightning bugs, though. And that started Sarah thinking about pollinators and native plants.
The loss of lightning bugs is not inevitable. Like, there are things that we can do to help support their populations. If you love something, care for it. About a year ago, I started distributing native plant seeds for free on street poles, in little jars in cafes, at bars, like anywhere where people were gathering. I put plant seeds so people wouldn't have to think too hard about taking the first step toward doing something positive for the environment. I want to make it easy and non-intimidating for people to take that first step in the hopes that then they continue taking actions to protect the environment.
Planting native plant seeds in a pot outside or maybe the edge of some vacant space near you brings some beauty to your street and gives our smallest neighbors the food or habitat they need to survive.
Sometimes people will tell me, hey, look, these are the flowers that we picked up. Like, we picked up seeds from your poster or whatever, and we planted them, and here they are flowering. Like, we did it.
The project was such a success, she's doing it again. As she grows the project, she could use a helping hand to spread the seeds around.
I am preparing to do the native plant project again this winter, and I need help packing like 15 pounds of plant seeds into teeny tiny little like wax paper bags. I just need all hands on deck, honestly. So November 19th, we're going to get together again at Indy Hall in Northern Liberties. If you're willing to help me spoon some seeds into packets, like, please come on over.
Science communication is Sarah's specialty, and moth nights and seed projects are just the tip of the iceberg. She has a Squid Facts text hotline, public murals with educational QR codes, and lots more. You can learn more about her work, sign up for the Native Plant Project, check out amazing art and all the rest on skypeascientist.com or on Instagram at Sarah McAttack. She's a Sarah with an H. At a time when we often hear about independent bookstores going out of business, there's one kind of bookshop that's actually becoming more popular than ever: stores that specialize in romance fiction. My co-host Samantha Roll spoke to the owners of two local romance bookstores to find out more.
Business has been booming for romance over the last few years. According to Publishers Weekly, romance sales rose almost 9% last year, while total unit sales of print books only rose 1%. As readership grows, romance bookstores have been popping up around the country. In the last year alone, two new bookshops have opened in the area that focus exclusively on romantic fiction. Kiss and Tale opened in Collingswood last year. And earlier this year, Cupid's Bookshop opened in Manayunk with the help of the Manayunk Incubator Space. The opening of these bookstores coincides with a burgeoning understanding of romance as a worthwhile genre. Much of its rise in popularity is thanks to the online literary community nicknamed BookTok that makes its home on TikTok. Cupid's Bookshop owner Tina Long says that the COVID-19 pandemic provided a place and time for people to reevaluate their perceptions of romance.
All of a sudden, you know, people are reading books they normally don't read, just from listening and watching other people's recommendations. And I think the book community just became a little more safe in talking about the more odd books and recommending books to each other.
And that reevaluation has been felt across the bookselling world.
Romance has always been kind of on the back burner, always hidden in the back corners of bookstores. I've been to bookstores in like Boston and wherever, and they're like, oh, we don't carry romance here. I think it's always made fun of. But I think now people are not afraid to talk about it. And I think because of Bookstore and BookTok. And it's now one of the highest performing fictional genres in like all bookstores.
Tina Long also credits a bookstore called The Ripped Bodice for paving the way for romance bookstores. The Ripped Bodice, which opened in California in 2016, was the first romance bookstore in the United States. Now, with a thriving second location in Brooklyn, New York, they set the standard for romance bookstores across the country.
They let people feel like it's a great time to do this, and they made us feel a little bit more emboldened.
These bookstores show that more and more people are willing to give romance a chance. But Katie Cunningham, owner of Kiss and Tale, says that there used to be a stigma around enjoying romance.
I've always been a huge reader, and I've always gravitated towards romance. I love A Happily Ever After. I love a love story. When I was growing up in high school in the early 2000s, it was just something I wasn't comfortable talking about. It was like a lot of hiding the books you're reading and feeling a little bit of shame for it.
She also says there is so much more to romance than meets the eye.
There's fantasy romance, dark romance, contemporary romance. There's romances that'll make you laugh. There's ones that'll make you cry. Ones that'll make you swoon. There's adventure. Everybody looks at romance as being so linear when really it's this huge web that can go into so many different directions. And when you start seeing it like that and appreciating romance in all its aspects and the facets, everybody kind of wants to put romance in this box, but there's not a box big enough to hold everything that romance represents. And I love that.
Both bookstore owners say that the romance community has shown up and shown out. These days, the bookselling market is dominated by online retailers like Amazon and large chain stores like Barnes & Noble. But there's also a push to support independent sellers or shop small. Cupid's Bookshop owner Tina Long believes that independent bookstores have something to offer that big box retailers don't.
I think people want a more curated selection. With Barnes & Noble, for example, they're huge. They have almost every book, but they've got to filter through their inventory so quickly. We just have more romance books, more than like two or three shelves. And you can just scour through an author's, a lot of their work, versus like their top sellers.
Another benefit of independent bookstores? The sense of community they foster. Both bookstore owners say romance readers come from all over to visit their stores. With events like book clubs and author signings, these stores carve out joyful communities where there was once shame.
We have 4 book clubs, which is insane, but they're always so much fun. Our store becoming a huge source of a community, and at least in our Manayunk area, was not a part of my initial goal. You know, it was for me just spreading romance books around Philly. But now it's become such a huge part of why I opened the store, because I started meeting so many great people and having so much fun in our book clubs and events that now it's become such a pillar of our store.
And Kiss and Tail owner Katie Cunningham says she was blown away by the response since her bookstore opened last year.
I was yearning for community within the romance world, and I was searching for it, and I wanted it so bad that I was like, fine, if nobody else is going to do it, I'm just going to make it happen. And I'm so glad I did. It's been the funnest adventure ever. I couldn't have prepared myself for the support we've gotten from the romance community, from readers, from the book community. Romance readers are the happiest people ever, and they all want to support each other. So it's pretty cool to see like everybody kind of come together in the store and want to talk about the books they're reading.
While running a brick-and-mortar bookstore is no easy feat, Katie Cunningham and Tina Long find the community they've built to be well worth it. Tina Long and her husband also teamed up to open a new genre-specific bookstore in Manayunk called Thrillerdelphia that focuses on horror and thriller books. As for Katie Cunningham...
Not a day has gone by where I've questioned the decision to open up the first romance bookstore in New Jersey. It's been amazing.
If you're planning a night out in Philly, it's not hard to find something to do. There's always something exciting going on in the nation's 6th largest city. But one group is bringing a different flair to the nightclub scene in the heart of Philly's gayborhood. Block by Block reporter Angie Boccia hit the dance floor to find out more.
It's Friday night, and friends Evan and Devin are going out dancing.
I'm here tonight because I wanted to hang out with my friend here.
Hi.
And we thought it'd be really fun to kind of be in the gayborhood, be with some kind of fellow queer folk.
We're always looking for things to do where we can be around other queer people, especially in a bigger city.
But while many people think that going out dancing means partying until late at night, Evan and Devin are out early on this Friday evening. It's only 7 o'clock. And the music at this club is a little different than what you would usually hear in the clubs in the gayborhood.
We saw a bunch of people walk out of a door with a bunch of cowboy boots on, thought it looked interesting, and then they all told us to come here, and now we're here.
Evan and Devin are at Giddy Up Philly's Country Line Dancing, a queer-led weekly dance meetup that has been going on for over 10 years. But DJ Hugo, the leader of Giddy Up, says that the movement has really only been taking off within the last couple of years, especially with the younger crowd.
Like, I remember when the average age was like 45, 50. Mm-hmm. And now it's like 24.
Line dancing is a form of dance where you learn choreography and then do those steps on repeat, facing different walls each time. Think the electric slide or Cotton Eye Joe. It has its roots in country music, although DJ Hugo says that he was not a fan when he was first introduced all the way back in 2013.
I was out for a drink one day by myself, and then I saw someone that I felt like I wanted to buy a drink. I invited him a drink. He said yes. We started talking, and then I tried to buy him another one, and he said, no, thank you. Right away, your mind starts going, you know, what did I say? Is it me? Whatever. He just right away said, hey, I'm going upstairs for lessons. There's country line dancing. Do you want to come? And I said, no. I said, no, thank you. I don't like country and I don't like that.
That seems to be a bit of a theme.
Not a country fan. Up until I started line dancing, and it is like my number one genre. It's everything I listen to now, which is really interesting, having not listened to that before.
That's Bailey Chaucer, one of the choreographers at Giddy Up. And although they do choreograph line dances to modern pop artists like Charlie XCX or Doechii,
I personally love dancing to the country songs.
So what draws people to this and changes their minds? What makes newcomers who are tentatively trying out steps on the sidelines want to come back? Maybe it has something to do with community.
It's one of those moments where you can walk in and absolutely have no idea what's going on and be super overwhelmed, and someone will be there to help you, which I think is super cool. It's a place too where there's lessons every week, so you can actually just like gradually introduce yourself to it. And so you can walk into a space in a bar and a nightclub, a space that could be intimidating for people, and then find a queer and inclusive space. You can walk in and be like, wow, there's a lot of people like me dancing to country songs. It's almost like the gays are reclaiming country, in my opinion, in a lot of these spaces, which is really cool.
Over the years, DJ Hugo has seen that community grow through queer line dancing practice groups popping up in other parts of the city, through people bringing their parents to dance nights, and even through marriages formed out of love's first spark on the dance floor.
I feel joy. I feel like they're like my kids in a way. But in the end, we're all together. Like once we're dancing on Fridays, everybody's like one.
But what if you mess up?
The fact that you're dancing next to someone that might also not be the most expert, and then you're both messing up on a certain section of the dance, and then you looked at each other, and then you giggle. You know, like that forms some sort of bond. You're being vulnerable with another person. And then, you know, like it's such an icebreaker too. It's so easy to start those conversations and be friendly.
And will line dancing keep getting more and more popular? The future is, of course, unpredictable. But Bailey and Hugo say the dance itself may be just too irresistible.
Warning, it is like highly addictive and super fun, and soon you'll be here every Friday night just like me.
I can't see myself not doing it.
Block by Block is produced by Angie Baccia, Ivan Felder III, Kalisa Hamid, Amanda Johnson, Vanessa Lowe, Winter Schneider, Kennedy Scurry, Campbell Simmons, and us,
Samantha Roll
and Helen Horseman Allen. Campbell Simmons is our board operator tonight.
Brad Linder is radio news managing editor for WPPM. Peter Liu is radio operations manager. And Allison Durham is WPPM's radio programs manager.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode of Block by Block featuring more stories about issues affecting life in the Philly region. And you can find past episodes of the show on PhillyCam SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you find your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.